Good evening. I would like to introduce our speaker this evening, Dr. Doug Groteis. He is the professor of philosophy at Denver Seminary, where he directs the Philosophy of Religion master's degree. He is the author and editor of 12 books, including Truth Decay, On Jesus, On Pascal, In Defense of Natural Theology, as well as many other publications in academic journals, such as Religious Studies, Inquiry, Research in Philosophy and Technology, and Sophia. His comments on religion, science, and culture have been published in newspapers and magazines such as Time, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, and The Rocky Mountain News. He has recently debated the scientific status of intelligent design on Denver Fox Television as well as Boulder Public Radio. Would you please welcome Dr. Doug Groteis?
Welcome, everyone. Our title this evening is Christianity and Science, Strangers, Enemies, or Friends. We've heard a lot about science and the philosophy of science in the public classroom recently. There was recently an article in Time magazine, January 31st of 2005, called Stealth Attack on Evolution. And I want to read a comment that was made by someone interviewed in this article that really sets the tone for what I want to discuss. They interviewed a person by the name of Jeffrey Moen, who describes himself as a very religious Methodist and also a teacher at a high school, and he said, "I also believe that God is ultimately responsible for the process of nature, but it is not our job to dust for fingerprints." Now that is a very interesting remark made by a Christian. And it fits the received model or the template that we hear every day in our culture about the relationship of religion in general and Christianity in particular to the discoveries and deliverances of science. And it's a perspective that I want to challenge. But let me fill it out before we talk about the various ways of relating Christianity and science, that is, strangers, enemies, or friends. And I will defend the thesis that, in fact, many scientific discoveries support certain claims of the Christian worldview. But the received template for understanding the relationship of Christianity and science is this. Christianity and science represent disparate ways of thinking. They don't really overlap. Christianity, and all religion, in fact, has nothing significant to say about science. That is, it must stick to the private and personal and subjective realm, and it must leave the facts to the scientists. It can be the realm of values. Religion speaks to values, the subjective, but not to objective facts. And part of this template is the idea that science will either contradict religion or it will have nothing to say to it at all. So the two are, in fact, strangers, or they may be enemies. The claim often given in our culture, on television, in magazines and newspapers, is that those that think that Christianity are ultimately friends must be ignorant, misguided, or worse. Now, just as a foretaste to the kind of claim I'm going to make, let me call your attention to a very well-known atheist by the name of Anthony Flew. Former atheist, I should say. Anthony Flew was probably the most well-respected spokesman for atheism in the last 30 to 50 years. And just recently, he converted from atheism to a form of theism through an investigation of the sort of scientific evidence that I'm going to be presenting to you. And this really rocked the intellectual world, because Anthony Flew would debate the most noteworthy Christian philosophers, such as William Lane Craig and Gary Habermas and others, defending atheism. And just within the last year or so, he has come around to a form of theism. He's not a Christian, but certain evidences from science convinced him that reality was larger than nature alone, that nature alone could not adequately explain certain aspects of nature. And we'll develop that as we go along. But what I'd like to do is look at the basic categories that people employ to relate Christianity and science, the categories of strangers, enemies, and then I will defend the view that, in fact, there is scientific support for certain claims in the Christian worldview, that rightly understood, Christianity and science are not enemies, but, in fact, friends, and I will defend a claim from cosmology, the Big Bang theory, and I'll give two evidences from the world of design, the fine-tuning argument, and the argument from certain subsystems of biology, such as the bacterial flagellum, and we'll have a short video clip at that point that illustrates what I'm going to say very clearly and very powerfully. Let's try to understand the categories of the discussion. Point two. First of all, we need to ask ourselves, what is truth? What are we after here? Religion and science both make truth claims. That is, they both claim to stake out objective facts about reality. So my approach here is the approach of realism. It's not what scientific theory gets the most research money or what religion is the most popular in an opinion poll. The issue is truth or facts about reality. And religions historically and perennially claim to represent reality correctly. They make truth claims about ultimate reality, about the human condition, and about spiritual liberation. And there are truth claims made by various scientific theories as well. So that sets the foundation for what we want to do. Now, if we're trying to understand the relationship of Christianity and science with respect to truth, the truth about the universe, we need to have some kind of an understanding of what we mean by Christianity. So let me explain what I mean by this. In three categories, origination, fall, and redemption. And then we'll say what we mean by science. And that's quite a disputed topic. But we have to lay out and describe the situation before we're going to make any progress on it. So by Christianity, or the Christian worldview, the Christian understanding of reality, the first category is origination. The claim of the Bible is that a personal, moral, and transcendent God made the world good and humans very good. The universe is an open system of cause and effect. That is, the universe is orderly, it is knowable, it is intelligible, but it is not self-enclosed. God created it, God designed it, and God is free to intervene within it, but according to his rational pattern of revelation. The second category is the fall. All humans, except Jesus Christ, fell away from God's design and into rebellion against God, such that all of life is disordered and fractured by sin, or by turning away from God and his good plans for humanity. I like to hear those pages turning. Thank you. I hope they keep turning as I keep going. The third point is redemption. We have origination, fall, and redemption or liberation. God did not abandon his creation, but reached out to fallen humans through the witness of nature, and we'll be discussing that primarily, the witness or the testimony, the revelation of nature, his prophets, the nation of Israel, and the coming of Jesus Christ, the crucified, resurrected, and ascended Lord of the universe. And the book of Romans gives you a very clear, thorough, systematic account of this. If I would try to boil down the Christian worldview into one proposition, this is what it would be. The universe, originally good, now fallen, and awaiting its divine restoration, is created by the triune God who has revealed himself in nature, conscience, scripture, and the incarnation of Jesus Christ. And I think across the board, throughout history and globally, almost all of those who identify with Christianity would affirm something like this. Now, what do we mean by science? This is a very contested, debated question. The common definition is that science pursues materialistic explanations for natural phenomena through empirical observation and rational theorizing. Something needs to be noted about this sort of definition. The definition may not be overtly stated. It may be covert. It may be tacit. It may be more presupposed than it's overtly stated. But this common definition that is part of this template that I talked about earlier in how religion relates to science has a philosophical presupposition or commitment that I want to expose and have you think about. This definition of science is philosophical naturalism or materialism. It is not a finding of science itself. This definition would exclude any non-natural explanation as unscientific in principle. It excludes intelligence as having causal primacy in any natural system. And the argument I'm going to make from the Big Bang, from fine-tuning, and from the bacterial flagellum is that intelligence best explains certain features of nature. We don't appeal to Scripture. We don't appeal to some mystical revelation, but we attempt to interpret the book of nature aright, according to rational principles. And the argument will be that intelligence or intelligent causes explain certain features of nature better than mindless material processes. Now, the received view has not always been the view in the Western world by any means, but one might say that ever since Darwin, it has been a presupposition of most science, and this is very clear in the blind watchmaker thesis of Richard Dawkins in his book of the same title. He will not allow any intelligent cause to explain anything in nature. He says that is not science, that is irrational, that is mysticism. I'm going to dispute that claim as we go along. So let me propose an alternative definition for what scientific enterprise is. Science pursues the best explanation for natural phenomena through empirical observation and rational theorizing. This may include causes that are not entirely explicable on naturalistic grounds, that is, intelligent causes. Now, I'm not saying we must bring in the Bible or we must bring in a supernatural revelation. The focus of concern is the natural world. But the question is this: can the natural world exhaustively explain itself apart from some sort of designing intelligence? So this is not the case of someone trying to sneak religion into science. The question is rather, is there possibly some scientific evidence for a designer that transcends the material world? That's the proper way to put it. Now, many people, of course, deny this, and let me begin with the category of Christianity and science as strangers. That is, science does not contribute to Christianity rationally, or vice versa. They are different domains, different areas of concern. The claim is they address different matters, so they do not conflict. They don't mutually support each other, neither do they conflict. Or someone might claim, in this stranger view, that Christianity and science address the same matters, but with a different focus, so they don't conflict. So for point A, you might say, well, science deals with atoms and religion deals with angels. And you can't really study an angel scientifically, and what does religion have to say about atoms? Or you might say they address the same matters, but with a different focus. So someone might say something like, science addresses the how and the when of nature, but religion addresses the why. Something like that. Now, these two categories are helpful in some instances, but they are really not the model that I think should be employed. Stephen Jay Gould tried to develop this view in his book, Rocks of Ages, Science and Religion in the Fullness of Life. And he developed an idea called non-overlapping magisteria. That is, you have the teaching authority of science and you have the teaching authority of religion, and they do not overlap. So they cannot come into conflict. So all the supposed conflicts between the deliverances of religion and the deliverances of science are apparent and not real. This is sort of a peacekeeping strategy to cut down on culture wars and lawsuits and so on. Now, this is what works out on this model. You end up with a fact-value dichotomy. Science is left to address the objective facts and to give knowledge. See, in a culture, whoever controls what is taken to be knowledge has the most impact and effect on the culture. And the notion is that science is left with the facts, what can be measured, what can be ascertained, what can be tested, and it derives knowledge, meaning a justified true belief, not mere opinion, but deliverances about reality. And then religion, and Christianity in particular, is only left then with this view with subjective values and mere opinion. So the way the pie is divided up is that science gets the facts, the objective realities, and knowledge, and religion gets private subjective opinion. Now, what is wrong with that view? Christianity and science make some claims about the same matters with the same focus. Now, we don't expect any religious text to be as detailed as a modern scientific description. But nevertheless, if you're considering the Bible, you see that the Bible makes certain core, basic, fundamental claims about the origin of the universe, that the universe has not always existed. It was brought forth by God out of nothing. That is a claim about the origin of the space-time universe. It's not merely a claim about someone's personal, private, subjective belief, although many people, myself included, believe that. It is a claim about factuality. And I will give you some reasons to believe that claim on the basis of cosmology in a moment. Moreover, the Bible claims that the universe is not an accident, a cosmic accident. It was created and it was designed. And moreover, that there are signs of design in the natural world. That is a claim given in the Christian Bible. It's not merely that some people believe there is design in their heart of hearts, although they do and I do, but that the universe itself evidences design in an objective manner that can be detected through empirical means. I won't deal with this specifically tonight, but Christianity also claims that human beings are unique among the living, that they possess an immaterial soul, and they cannot be reduced to merely material parts. That's for another lecture. But these are three claims made by Orthodox Christianity that can be addressed in the domain of science because they touch on the things that science is interested in: cosmology, the design of nature, and the nature of persons. So the stranger view simply does not adequately address the claims made by Christianity. The fact-value distinction grants science the exclusive right to define objective reality. Science then becomes the master of reality and the master of religion by banishing religion to the subjective and irrational sphere. Now, what about the view that Christianity and science are really enemies? There is overt hostility, and science always wins by defeating Christianity, not by banishing it, but by defeating it. This claim is that science and Christianity make conflicting truth claims about objective reality, and science has won out and will continue to win out by refuting Christian claims. This would be the claim by someone like Richard Dawkins in his book I mentioned previously, The Blind Watchmaker. He claims that religion is the enemy of reason, science, and progress, and science has always turned back and pushed back and defeated religion time after time. And I've given you an interview as a link if you'd like to consult that. According to Dawkins, and he has many followers, science is the only way to know reality. And he defines science, of course, naturalistically. It, by definition, excludes any primary intelligent causes. Any intelligence that exists in the universe has to be an evolved intelligence, not a primary intelligence that would explain anything fundamentally. Those are the rules of the game as laid down by Dawkins. Now, there are certain problems with this view. Scientism, as a philosophy, is self-refuting. It cannot abide by its own rules, therefore it's false. Scientism would claim the only thing we can really know are the things that are delivered to us by empirical observation, or maybe by necessary truths, like a triangle has three sides. Now, that claim itself, the only thing we can really know is what we know through empirical observation, or empirical inference, or necessary truths, is not itself a necessary truth or something we derive from empirical observations. So it sets up a standard for knowledge and epistemology that it itself cannot abide by. So therefore, it cannot be the exhaustive definition of knowledge. Now, denying scientism has nothing to do with denying the legitimacy of science if science is legitimately and correctly construed. But scientism is a kind of idolatry of science, not science in its purest form. Moreover, scientism, the worldview of Dawkins and his cohort, cannot explain our knowledge of moral truths and other kinds of truths, things that are clearly known, but we do not know them through any scientific process, such as it is always wrong to torture the innocent for pleasure. Everyone in this room, I hope, knows that that's true. Do you know it through biology, chemistry, physics? No. you know it intuitively as an a priori truth. Moreover, what I'm going to argue briefly and suggestively is that certain scientific findings lend intellectual support to the Christian worldview. Now, I don't say prove it conclusively in all of its aspects, but lend significant intellectual support to certain elements of the Christian worldview. So let me go on and talk about Christianity and science as friends. A few first steps. Historically, we need to set something straight. The story you would hear from a Richard Dawkins or from many other people today, or you may have heard in the classroom here at Colorado State University, maybe you haven't, is that Christianity has always opposed scientific development. It has always challenged the scientists and viewed them as heretics and tried to squelch the development of scientific knowledge. There are a few cases that get a lot of press that are blown far out of proportion, such as the Galileo case. Galileo was a Christian, and he thought that what he was discovering was in harmony with the Bible. He was challenging some philosophy inherited by Aristotle, not truly anything delivered in the scripture itself, but I don't want to emphasize that. Let me point out that in the scientific revolution, the leading theorists of that day, I'm talking about people like Copernicus, Newton, Kepler, Pascal, Faraday, and others, were Christian theists or theists. And their basic model was that God created the book of nature as knowable, as interpretable, and as good. And God has also revealed himself in the book of Scripture, the word written. So you have nature and Scripture, one creator over both, one revealer, the revealer of nature, the revealer of Scripture. The claim was, that motivated these scientists was, they are both true. So the scientists should try to interpret the book of nature properly. They were impelled to do so by their religious faith. This point has been made by many thinkers throughout history, Alfred North Whitehead being one, Stanley Yockey being another, but most recently Rodney Stark, the sociologist, well-respected thinker, has written a book called For the Glory of God, Chapter 2. He documents this in detail, that these thinkers believe that nature was worthwhile, it was knowable, it was intelligible, and it should be developed for the glory of God and for the good of creation. And they did not see their investigations and their theorizing in any way out of step with the deliverances of the Bible. Now, I point that out because we have a kind of common story in our culture that takes a slice of history and inflates it into the whole story. In some cases, the Catholic Church opposed some findings of some scientists, but that was not the norm. It was not typical. It was not systematic. In fact, this is the point. The Christian worldview gave impetus to the development of modern science. Now, that in itself does not prove that Christianity is true. And it does not prove that nature itself gives evidence for certain claims within the Christian worldview. But it does help deflate a particular stereotype that is extremely harmful. And I've given you a few references here. There are many, many more. Something else to consider as a first step about Christianity and science actually being friends and not strangers or enemies. And that is the theistic assumptions that are required for scientific enterprise. Not every worldview will claim the things I'm about to stipulate. Theistic assumptions required for science. And scientists today, even if they're not theists, still tend to affirm these things because they are necessary to the scientific enterprise itself. First, that there is such a thing as objective truth, and that it's knowable. Not everyone believes that. Not every culture believes that. That the universe is orderly and can be understood. It's not so mysterious or dark and bizarre that we couldn't fathom what it means. That mathematics can connect the human mind with objective reality. Not all cultures have believed that. The ancient Greeks did not believe that. They developed mathematics, but it was very theoretical to them. They didn't really connect it to nature. Why? They didn't have a doctrine of creation. Matter was lower. Matter was lesser. It was something to be transcended. Christianity says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and it was good. And human beings are good. And human beings should develop the creation according to their abilities. The God-given creation developed by their God-given abilities. Another claim necessary for scientific progress and development is that certain moral values are conducive to scientific progress. And you can't derive this from science itself, such as honesty in investigation, honesty in sharing data, impartiality, not stacking the deck, not cooking the books, generosity, sharing your findings so scientific enterprise can continue and develop. These are values very much at home within a Christian worldview. Moreover, there's a continuing contribution of Christians in the realm of science, and Stark documents that very well with sociological data. All right, now I really want to get to the meat of what I want to say, and that is the arguments that lend support to certain aspects of the Christian worldview from what I'll call the book of nature, to hark back to that great tradition of the scientific revolution. The first is Big Bang cosmology. Then I will look at fine-tuning and the bacterial flagellum. And I refer you to the fine book, there are many books, Paul Copan and William Lane Craig, Creation Out of Nothing. There is a scientific argument for the absolute origination of the universe. There are philosophical arguments, and I could spend all night with those, but I'll give you simply the argument from Big Bang cosmology. By absolute origination, I mean that the universe sprang forth out of nothing. That is, out of nothing spatial or material. There was a true first event. Now, how do we get there? I have to summarize quickly here. But Einstein's general theory of relativity in 1917, still turning pages, good sign, contained an error. He built in a fudge factor, but when this error, he divided by zero, Einstein, he divided by zero, when this error was corrected, it predicted an expanding universe. Now, this was unheard of in previous cosmology, an expanding universe. The idea was the universe is static. It doesn't change. General theory of relativity, when it was corrected by a Belgian astronomer, Georges Lemaître, and a Russian mathematician, Alexander Friedman, predicted an expanding universe. Now, it's all theoretical so far. But the theory was then verified in several dimensions over a period of decades. This became known as the Friedman-Lemaître model, or the standard Big Bang model. In 1929, an American astronomer by the name of Edwin Hubble, through his powerful telescope, detected the redshift in distant galaxies. This indicated that what was further away was moving at a greater speed. So there is empirical evidence to help verify the prediction made theoretically through the redshift, evidence of expansion. Of course, all these points could be expanded on, but I'm going quickly. Another point of verification, confirmation, is the detection of cosmic background radiation left over from the initial condition of the universe, a second aspect of confirmation. You also have the reality of thermodynamics. That is, that energy reaches a state of equilibrium. The second law of thermodynamics, that available energy is running down. Now, if the universe were infinitely old, we would reach at this point a state of complete equilibrium with no available energy. Now, of course, we do have available energy because we have a microphone, and we have lights, and we're all living. So we have not reached total equilibrium. What is the implication of this? The second law of thermodynamics, very well established. It's a universal law for the whole universe. It's not just for some local part of it. Let me read you a statement by Paul Davies, the science writer and physicist. Today, few cosmologists doubt that the universe, at least as we know it, did have an origin, a finite moment in the past. The alternative, that the universe has always existed in one form or another, runs into a rather basic paradox. The sun and stars cannot keep burning forever. Sooner or later, they will run out of fuel and die. The same is true of all irreversible physical processes. The stock of energy available in the universe to drive them is finite and cannot last for an eternity. This is an example of the so-called second law of thermodynamics, which, applied to the entire cosmos, predicts that it is stuck on a one-way slide of degeneration and decay toward a final state of maximum entropy, or disorder. As this final state has not yet been reached, it follows that the universe cannot have existed for an infinite time. So this is the upshot from the Big Bang cosmology and from the second law of thermodynamics. The universe came into existence a finite time ago. The estimates are usually 13 to 15 billion years ago. So let me read you a statement by Barrow and Tipler in their book, The Anthropic Cosmological Principle, Oxford University Press, 1986. They speak of a singularity. At this singularity, space and time came into existence. Literally, nothing existed before the singularity. So, if the universe originated in such a singularity, we would truly have a creation ex nihilo. Ex nihilo means out of nothing. A creation ex nihilo, out of nothing. Now, there were alternative theories, such as the steady-state cosmology and the oscillating universe cosmology. These either lacked empirical evidence or contradicted known laws of physics, or both. They didn't fare very, very well. Now, there are some other alternatives that are out there, but they are not as well established as the standard Big Bang model, which gives us this singularity, this creation out of nothing. Let me read the conclusion by Copan and Craig in their book, Creation Out of Nothing. It can be confidently said that, with regard to the standard Big Bang model, no cosmogonic model has been as repeatedly verified in its predictions, as corroborated by attempts at its falsification, as concordant with empirical discoveries, and as philosophically coherent. So, an initial singularity, creation out of nothing. Let me give you another principle. This is a philosophical principle. Many physicists have seen this to be cogent. Whatever begins to exist, including the universe itself, whatever begins to exist has a cause of its existence. The alternative would be that something, in fact, everything, comes from nothing without a cause. There's an old Latin phrase that captures this problem, ex nihilo nihil fit. It means from nothing, nothing comes, because there would be nothing for it to come from. So we have a singularity, ex nihilo. The most rational conclusion, then, is that the universe was caused by an immaterial originator who possessed the power and the wisdom to create what we now observe. The alternative would be everything from nothing without a cause. This is sometimes called the pop theory. And some people bite the bullet. They say we have to recognize the evidence. The other cosmologies don't work, the other theories of origin. Everything came from nothing, but we certainly don't want to admit a divine originator, so we say that everything came from nothing without a cause. This is sometimes called Big Bang mysticism. And I think it may take more faith to believe that than to believe that there was a divine origination for the universe. The claim here is that the originator set in motion the many factors needed for life in the universe. And I'll make this point in a moment. So we have the origination and the design, the nature of the universe. So I've tried to give a short argument from science, not appealing to any holy book, from scientific theories, a very well-established, long-standing theory, the standard Big Bang model, for the absolute origination of the universe by a cause outside of the universe. Now you might say, what has this cause done? What does the universe look like? We have an absolute origination, but can we detect anything else about the universe that would give us an indication of the nature of this originator? Here, let me quickly go through two elements of design which I believe are evident in nature. First of all, let me talk about the science of design detection. And I'm dealing here with some theories developed by William Dembski, a very brilliant mathematician and philosopher, developed in his book, The Design Inference. What we are looking for when we're looking for design is specified complexity. Let me give you an example of detecting design in nature, Mount Rushmore. When you see Mount Rushmore, you don't assume that the faces were formed merely by erosion and the wind. Why? Because it is very complex. You have the faces of presidents, and those complexities fit an independently definable pattern, independently specifiable pattern. We know that these presidents existed, and we know what they look like from looking at their faces in photographs or on money or something like that. So when we look at Mount Rushmore, even if we had never known that someone chiseled it, we would see complexity and specified complexity. The same concept of design detection is used in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Some of you may have seen the movie Contact. Now, no extraterrestrial intelligence has yet been discerned, but the way it would be detected is a specified complex message, something that doesn't just appear over and over again through a law of nature, and something that's not random and which cannot be deciphered. In the movie, the idea was they were sending a message. It was information. So we know information, a type of specified complexity, has a designer, has a sender. There is a sender of this message. This element of design detection is also used in archaeology. If an archaeologist is trying to discern whether something is just a piece of rock or an old pot or some kind of an artifact, the archaeologist looks for evidences or signs of intelligence, an intelligent cause. So you look for something that has complexity and a specified complexity. Let's say a vase that has a drawing on it, that has some detail and that is of a face. You see complexity, you see specification, and you infer intelligence. This is also used in cryptography. The point is that we have well-recognized sciences that use this art of design detection. What you try to do with any object is see if you can explain it merely by chance, what we don't understand and what can't be explained by natural law. See if it can be explained merely by natural law, reoccurring patterns without specificity. And if it can't, whether it's a message from outer space or whether it's a vase with a face on it, we infer intelligence. This leaves intelligent causes as the explanation. And if you have an intelligent cause explaining some natural object, you infer some kind of a mind behind it to explain the artifact or to explain the object. You would not refer to mindless processes, that is, mere laws or chance. In fact, the laws themselves are best explained by fine-tuning, as I'll mention in a moment. But the fine-tuning we see indicates a divine mind. The complexity is not due to chance or natural law. It is specified in that it fits an intelligent, intelligible, and recognizable pattern. Now, let me quickly give you two arguments from nature, and if we have time, I want to show you about 10, 15 minutes of a very powerful video about something at the very small, microscopic level. But let's start at the universe as a whole, the fine-tuning of the universe as a whole, anthropic considerations. Only within the last several decades has it been discovered that there are various constants in the universe that are required for human life, that are required for carbon-based life, and that is the only kind of life we know of in the universe anyway. These are all necessary for life. So life observers, us being here, these factors are necessary. That's the specification. Observers. These are life-permitting variables. The number and variety of these life-permitting variables is vast. Hugh Ross keeps a running count of this on his website. The last number that he has given is that there are at least 77 of these factors, these constants in the universe, necessary for supporting life and for supporting observers. Think of these as dials. You have a dial with many, many different variables, hundreds or thousands of variables, and you tune it to one specific thing. Then you have another one with hundreds or thousands of possibilities. You tune it to a specific marker. You do this 77 times, and all of them have to be just right to have life-conducive conditions, to fit the specificity of life. The margin of error for these life-permitting variables is infinitesimal. Let me read you something from Stephen Hawking that makes this point. If the rate of expansion 1 second after the Big Bang had been smaller by even one part in 100,000 million million, the universe would have recollapsed before it ever reached its present size. On the other hand, if the expansion rate at 1 second had been larger by the same amount, the universe would have expanded so much that it would be effectively empty now. He also goes on to say that if the electronic charge of the electron had been only slightly different, stars either would have been unable to burn hydrogen and helium, or else they would have exploded. So Hawking, who doesn't follow the perspective that I'm giving you, still realizes that the fine-tuning is tremendously specific. Tremendously specific. If it had not been what it was, it could not have generated these important heavier chemicals and the rest of what I claimed. So what we're arguing here is that these sorts of features indicate a mind, a fine-tuning mind. It's far more probable that these were tuned by a mind than they are mere chance. They are not mere natural law, because they are not required to be this way. They are contingent. The universe could have been very different. This is not physically impossible. So what is the best explanation for this plethora of cosmic constants? Some would say chance, sheer dumb luck. Now, this is very, very improbable statistically, and I haven't even developed all that for you. But let me give you some ways out that people have given. Not a divine mind that tuned them for life, to allow life and to allow knowers. One approach has been called the many-universe theory. That is, all right, you have all these features that have to be so finely tuned to make life possible. It is antecedently very improbable given one universe. So what do? We multiply universes tremendously, maybe even infinitely. So what you do is you expand the probability resources. You know, what are the chances if you have 10 die to throw it and get all sixes? Infinitesimal. What if you have 1 million, 1 billion, 100 billion people doing it? Well, somebody will probably do it. This is the thinking here. So you multiply universes, and we are the lucky universe. Now, what kind of a theory is that scientifically? Because the idea is we don't want to grant a divine mind outside of the universe to explain the fine-tuning. We want only natural explanations, because this is how so many people define what science is and what science must always do. You are moving from the evidence of design to no design. The evidence is there for design at the macroscopic level. It's also there at the microscopic level, which we'll see in a moment. You're moving from evidence for design to no design by multiplying empirically unobservable universes. Does this sound like a good scientific theory? It is not a simple explanation, because you're multiplying empirically unobservable other universes by possibly infinity. It is an extremely complex explanation, and all things being equal, you should try to explain what is the most simple. If you explain our universe as fine-tuned by God, that makes sense. That satisfies that simplicity condition. You multiply universes endlessly simply to avoid the design inference. First of all, it seems like special pleading, but it also makes it highly complex. There could be no empirical evidence for it because these other universes are empirically undetectable, according to this theory. And this view is actually more metaphysically highfalutin than theism. Theism claims there's one universe created by an absolute originator who fine-tuned it to make life possible. Not an infinite number of universes, and moreover, who generates all these other universes? We can't observe them. They're created basically out of nothing to avoid the design inference, but how do you explain the universe generator? This many-universe theory seems very ad hoc. It devoids inferring a divine mind at a very, very high cost. There's another way of getting out of the design inference with respect to fine-tuning. And this is what I call the no big deal response. Let me give you an example. This is Martin Rees from the Scientific American special issue in 2002. He gives five elements of fine-tuning, and then he says, no big deal. One, our universe could not have become structured if it were not expanding at a special rate. Two, if the Big Bang had produced fewer density fluctuations, the universe would have remained dark with no galaxies or stars. Three, if our universe had more than three spatial dimensions, planets could not stay in orbits around the stars. These are all necessary for life. Four, if gravity were much stronger, it would crush living organisms of human size, and stars would be small and short-lived. No life, no observers, no scientific theories. Fifth, if the nuclear force were a few percent weaker, only hydrogen would be stable. There would be no periodic table, no chemistry. Seems to be moving in a design direction, in a design inference. But he says this, some would argue that this fine-tuning of the universe, which seems so providential, is nothing to be surprised about, since we would not exist otherwise. No big deal. All these antecedently improbable things have to come about for there to be observers at all to notice them. This is a trick. This is sleight of hand. Let me explain it. It is confusing necessary conditions with sufficient explanation. It is confusing necessary conditions with sufficient explanation. Let me give you this example, taken from Bill Craig. Let's say you have the misfortune of being a target of a totalitarian regime, and you are brought before a firing squad of 20 marksmen. And at the count of five, they are going to shoot you, and their goal is to kill you. And they do good at this sort of thing. They're well trained. So you hear 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, pow! And you're still there. And you say, what happened? I was convicted. These are marksmen. And the person leading the execution squad says, it's no big deal. If they had hit you, you wouldn't be here to ask. What we need here is not just that the necessary conditions have obtained, but why did they obtain at all when they are so antecedently unlikely? For instance, we know that fire needs oxygen. Oxygen is a necessary condition for fire. But if we want to explain the Great San Francisco Fire, we don't say, well, you know, fire needs oxygen. We have to explain why the fire took place. So when we're looking at these, let's say, 77 cosmic constants, all have to be fine-tuned very carefully, independently of each other, to have a life-permitting universe, we ask, what is a sufficient explanation? Other universes that we create out of our mind? I don't think so. No big deal? That's avoiding the very challenge of giving an explanation. So, what else might people say about the fine-tuning? Well, some might say very quickly, these variables have to be the way they are. They're really not contingent. They're part of a grand unified law, and they all have to be the way they are. Some theory of everything. Well, that's a post-dated check. We have no evidence that that, in fact, is the case, and the evidence we now have is that these variables are variables. They're all contingent. They could have been otherwise. So the design explanation, the design inference, seems to make the most sense. There was a divine intelligence, an intelligence behind the fine-tuning, as we observe in other areas of life. We know how to detect design in other areas of life. You talk about something that's antecedently improbable without some sort of intelligence. It's not explicable entirely through natural law. So we're specifying for knowers for life, and we're saying that these variables are necessary for life, and they're best explained not by chance, not by brute natural law, but by a designing intelligence. That is a design inference. I'm not quoting Genesis 1:1. I'm not quoting anything in the Bible. But this, of course, would agree with the idea that in the beginning God created the heavens and earth, and he created it to be populated. He created it to be inhabited and to be developed by human beings who could know the universe and develop the universe. So I'm arguing that this gives us some scientific evidence for a crucial claim of the Christian worldview. All right, my last piece of evidence. I've talked about Big Bang. I've talked about the cosmic constants, the fine-tuning of the universe for life, best explained by design. The last, and I'll show a short video in a moment about this, and then I'll conclude and take questions, is what I call the amazing world of molecular machines. There's been a tremendous increase in scientific knowledge of the molecular world in the past 50 years. The microbiological world, or the microchemical world, is tremendously complex, far more complex than Darwin could have ever known. And a variety of machines, very sophisticated machines, have been detected through microscopic investigation. One of these machines that I want to show this short clip on in a moment is called the bacterial flagellum. And the bacterial flagellum, in many ways, is the poster boy of the intelligent design movement. And this has been popularized in Michael Behe's book, Darwin's Black Box. The claim about the flagellum, this is a tail-like structure that looks like a rotary outboard mower, is on the back, outboard motor, is on the back of a bacterium. And it is highly complex, and it requires many different parts to have its function. So the claim by Behe is that this aspect of nature, this machine, this molecular machine, and this is not a metaphor, it literally is a machine, exhibits what Behe calls irreducible complexity, meaning all the parts are required for the function to occur. He calls this the mousetrap principle. To have a functioning mousetrap, you need all the parts hooked up and working to have the mousetrap function. And to have the function of the flagellar motor, all of them need to be in place at once. Now realize that according to naturalism, the Darwinian explanation, things have to be built up through natural law and chance, no designing intelligence. So this flagellar motor has to be built up incrementally. And the film that I'll show you shows how implausible that naturalistic path to the flagellar motor, in fact, really is. This is from a video called Unlocking the Mysteries of Life. And you'll see Michael Behe explain the theory.
During the early 1990s, at a series of academic conferences, Behe first shared his doubts about the ability of natural selection to construct complex molecular machines. One machine particularly attracted his attention.
I remember the first time I looked in a biochemistry textbook and I saw a drawing of something called a bacterial flagellum with all of its parts in all of its glory. It's had a propeller and the hook region and the drive shaft and the motor and so on. I looked at that and I said, that's an outboard motor. That's designed, you know, that's no chance assemblage of parts.
Behe's reaction was not surprising, for the molecular motors that drive bacteria through liquid each depend upon a system of intricately arranged mechanical parts. These parts come into focus when portions of a cell are magnified 50,000 times. Biochemists have used electron micrographs like this one to identify the parts and three-dimensional structure of the flagellar motor. In the process, they have revealed a marvel of engineering on a miniaturized scale.
Howard Berg at Harvard has labeled it the most efficient machine in the universe. These machines, some of them are running at 100,000 RPMs and are hardwired into a signal transduction or sensory mechanism so that it's getting feedback from the environment.
And even though they're spinning that fast, they can stop on a dime. It only takes a quarter turn for them to stop and shift directions and start spinning 100,000 RPM in the other direction.
And just like outboard motors on motorboats, it has a large number of parts which are necessary for the motor to work.
The bacterial flagellum, two gears, forward and reverse, water-cooled, proton motive force, it has a stator, it has a rotor, it has a U-joint, it has a drive shaft, it has a propeller, and they function as these parts of machines. It's, you know, it's not convenient that we give them these names. That's truly their function.
Since its discovery, scientists have tried to understand how a rotary motor could have arisen through natural selection. As yet, they have failed to offer any detailed Darwinian explanation. To see why, we must understand a feature of molecular machines known as irreducible complexity.
Irreducible complexity was coined by Mike Behe in describing these molecular machines. Basically, what it says is that you have multi-component parts to any given organelle or system in a cell, all of which are necessary for function. That is, if you remove one part, you lose function of that system.
The idea of irreducible complexity can be illustrated by a familiar non-biological machine, a mousetrap. The trap is composed of five basic pieces: a catch to hold the bait, a strong spring, a thin bent rod called the hammer, a holding bar to secure the hammer in place, and a platform upon which the entire system is mounted. If any one of these parts is missing or defective, the mechanism will not work. All components of this irreducibly complex system must be present simultaneously for the machine to perform its function, catching mice. Irreducible complexity also applies to biological machines, including the bacterial flagellar motor.
All told, there are about 40 different protein parts which are necessary for this machine to work. And if any of those parts are missing, then either you get a flagellum that doesn't work because it's missing the hook or it's missing the drive shaft or whatever, or it doesn't even get built within the cell.
In evolutionary terms, you have to be able to explain how you can build this system gradually when there's no function until you have all those parts in place.
The irreducible complexity of molecular machines poses a severe challenge to the power of natural selection. According to Darwin's theory, even very complex biological structures like an eye, an ear, or a heart can be built gradually over time in small incremental steps. Yet, as Darwin made clear, natural selection can only succeed if these random genetic changes provide some advantage to the evolving organism in its struggle for survival.
As I have attempted to show, it is not necessary to suppose that the modifications were all simultaneous if they were extremely slight and gradual. Natural selection is scrutinizing the slightest variations, rejecting those that are bad, preserving and adding up all that are good.
But could Darwin's small, favorable variations have produced a bacterial flagellum? Some scientists doubt the possibility.
How could something new, like a bacterial flagellar motor and all the components that go with it, how could it develop out of a population of bacteria that don't have that system? When each change, according to Darwin's theory, has to provide some kind of advantage.
Imagine such a scenario early in the Earth's history. An evolving bacterium somehow develops a tail and perhaps even the pieces necessary to attach it to the cell wall. Yet without a complete motor assembly, this innovation would provide no advantage to the cell. Instead, the tail would lie immobile and useless, invisible to natural selection, which by definition can only favor changes that aid survival.
The logic of natural selection is very demanding. Unless the flagellum mechanism is completely assembled and actually works, natural selection simply cannot preserve it. It cannot be passed on to the next generation.
The important thing to realize about natural selection is it selects only for a functional advantage. In most cases, natural selection actually eliminates things that have no function or that have a function that harms the organism. So if you had a bacterium with a tail that didn't function as a flagellum, chances are natural selection would eliminate it. The only way you can select for a flagellum is if you have a flagellum that works, and that means you have to have all the pieces of the motor in place to begin with. So natural selection can't get you the bacterial flagellum. It can only work after the flagellum is there and operating.
In 1996, Michael Behe published a book titled Darwin's Black Box. In it, he argued that natural selection, Darwin's designer substitute, could not explain the origin of the bacterial flagellum or any other irreducibly complex biological system. Instead, Behe concluded that the integrated complexity of these systems pointed to intelligent design. Darwin's Black Box created immediate controversy. Over 75 publications, including some of the world's leading newspapers and scientific journals, reviewed the book. Some scientists praised Behe's work, while others dismissed it as unscientific and religiously motivated. Behe's critics also insisted that he had underestimated the power of natural selection. They argued that the flagellar motor could have been constructed from parts used to build simpler molecular machines, like this needle-nose cellular pump. If the components of the pump already existed, they could have been preserved by natural selection even before the bacterial motor arose. This theory is called co-option.
It's essentially saying that evolution or natural selection at some point was able to borrow components of one molecular machine and build a new machine with some of these components.
Scott Minnick has studied the flagellar motor for nearly 20 years. His research has led him to challenge the co-option argument.
With a bacterial flagellum, you're talking about a machine that's got 40 structural parts. Yes, we find 10 of them are involved in another molecular machine, but the other 30 are unique. So where are you going to borrow them from? Eventually, you're going to have to account for the function of every single part as originally having some other purpose. So you can only follow that argument so far until you run into the problem of you're borrowing parts from nothing. But even if you concede that you have all the parts necessary to build one of these machines, that's only part of the problem. Maybe even more complex, I think more complex, is the assembly instructions. That is never addressed by opponents of the irreducible complexity argument.
Studies of the bacterial motor have indeed revealed an even deeper level of complexity. For its construction, not only requires specific parts, but also a precise sequence of assembly.
You've got to make things at the right time. You've got to make the right number of components. You've got to assemble them in a sequential manner. You've got to be able to tell if you've assembled it properly so that you don't waste energy building a structure that's not going to be functional.
Building a molecular machine has been compared to the construction of a house, where workers follow a detailed blueprint and plan for assembly. The foundation of a house is poured before the walls are erected. Plumbing and electrical fixtures are installed prior to enclosing the walls of the structure. Windows must be hung before siding is applied, and shingles are attached only after plywood sheets are nailed to the rafters. So it is with the construction of a flagellar motor.
You build this structure from the inside out. You're counting the number of components in a ring structure or the stator. And once that's assembled, there's feedback that says, okay, no more of that component now. A rod is added. A ring is added. Another rod is added. U-joints added. Once the U-joint's at a certain size and a certain degree of bend, about a quarter turn, that's shut off, and then you start adding components for the propeller. These are all made in a precise sequence, just like you would build a building.
To build a motor correctly requires a complex system of machines that coordinate the timing of the assembly instructions. But how could natural selection construct such a system?
The co-option argument doesn't explain this. You see, in order to construct that flagellar mechanism, or tens of thousands of other such mechanisms in the cell, you require other machines to regulate the assembly of these structures. And those machines themselves require machines for their assembly.
If even one of these pieces is missing or put in the wrong place, your motor isn't going to work. So this apparatus to assemble the flagellar motor is itself irreducibly complex. In fact, what we have here is irreducible complexity all the way down.
We know a lot about the bacterial flagellum. We still have a lot to learn, but we know a lot about it. And there's no explanation for how this complex molecular machine was ever produced by a Darwinian mechanism.
150 years ago, scientists did not know about irreducibly complex molecular machines. Yet Charles Darwin anticipated the difficulty that systems such as these could pose to his theory.
If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down.
I certainly commend that entire DVD to you. We just saw about 12, 13 minutes of it. I think that explains it with the graphics extremely well. And the basic point to take from the bacterial flagellum is this concept of irreducible complexity and the inability of naturalism to explain it adequately given what we know about design detection. Now, those scientists and thinkers were critiquing natural selection. They weren't saying natural selection applies in no aspect of nature. They were saying natural selection is not the only mechanism needed to explain the development of life. It's been said that natural selection is very good in describing the survival of species, why species survive, but not very good at all explaining the arrival of species, or the arrival of these irreducibly complex systems like the bacterial flagellum, like the blood clotting cascade, and so on. The point is this, that naturalism is inadequate to explain certain aspects of nature, and that the design inference, which is a legitimate pattern of scientific inference, gives a better explanation of certain aspects of nature than a materialistic, naturalistic explanation. So chance would not explain this. Natural law cannot account for the specificity of the function. So the best explanation would be intelligent causation that accounts for the specificity of the complexity and its all-at-once irreducible functionality. Let me review what I've tried to do. I've tried to say that we face a challenging moment in American history where science is in the newspapers. The supposed conflict of science and religion. There are cases around the country about the teaching of challenges to naturalism in public schools. Some people say that Christianity and science are strangers. They really have very little to do with each other. Some say they're enemies, Richard Dawkins, and that science always wins. Science, meaning naturalism, metaphysical naturalism, will always trump any sort of claim coming from religion. My view has been a fairly modest view. I have not tried to verify the major aspects of Christianity through science. What I've tried to do is to say that given the Big Bang cosmology, given that it's well-received and well-established as a large-scale scientific theory, the best explanation for the universe is that it began a finite time ago, that it was created out of nothing. And rather than to say that everything came from nothing, the claim is that it was caused to exist by something outside of itself. And we found evidence of a designing mind looking at the very careful fine-tuning of all these different factors of life that make life possible. Then we shifted from the macroscopic to the microscopic and looked at merely one biological machine. There are dozens and dozens and hundreds of them, but one biological machine, fantastically complex, and as the film clip argued,